A model is a good model if it 1. Is elegant 2. Contains few arbitrary or adjustable elements 3. Agrees with and explains all existing observations 4. Makes detailed predictions about future observations that can disprove or falsify the model if they are not borne out. For example, Aristotle's theory that the world was made of four elements, earth, air, fire, and water, and that objects acted to fulfill their purpose was elegant and didn't contain adjustable elements. But in many cases it didn't make definite predictions, and when it did, the predictions weren't always in agreement with observation. One of these predictions was that heavier objects should fall faster because their purpose is to fall. Nobody seemed to have thought it was important to test this until Galileo. There is a story that he tested it by dropping weights from the Leaning Tower of Pisa. This is probably apocryphal, but we do know he rolled different weights down an inclined plane and observed that they all gathered speed at the same rate, contrary to Aristotle's prediction. The above criteria are obviously subjective. Elegance, for example, is not something easily measured, but it is highly prized among scientists because laws of nature are meant to economically compress a number of particular cases into one simple formula. Elegance refers to the form of a theory, but it is closely related to a lack of adjustable elements, since a theory jammed with fudge factors is not very elegant. To paraphrase Einstein, a theory should be as simple as possible, but not simpler. Ptolemy added epicycles to the circular orbits of the heavenly bodies in order that his model might accurately describe their motion. The model could have been made more accurate by adding epicycles to the epicycles, or even epicycles to those. Though added complexity could make the model more accurate, scientists view a model that is contorted to match a specific set of observations as unsatisfying, more of a catalogue of data than a theory likely to embody any useful principle. We'll see in Chapter 5 that many people view the standard model, which describes the interactions of the elementary particles of nature, as inelegant. That model is far more successful than Ptolemy's epicycles. It predicted the existence of several new particles before they were observed, and described the outcome of numerous experiments over several decades to great precision. But it contains dozens of adjustable parameters whose values must be fixed to match observations, rather than being determined by the theory itself. As for the fourth point, scientists are always impressed when new and stunning predictions prove correct. On the other hand, when a model is found lacking, a common reaction is to say the experiment was wrong. If that doesn't prove to be the case, people still often don't abandon the model but instead attempt to save it through modifications. Although physicists are indeed tenacious in their attempts to rescue theories they admire, the tendency to modify a theory fades to the degree that the alterations become artificial or cumbersome, and therefore inelegant. If the modifications needed to accommodate new observations become too baroque, it signals the need for a new model. One example of an old model that gave way under the weight of new observations was the idea of a static universe. In the 1920s, most physicists believed that the universe was static, or unchanging in size. Then, in 1929, Edwin Hubble published his observations showing that the universe is expanding. But Hubble did not directly observe the universe expanding. He observed the light emitted by galaxies. That light carries a characteristic signature, or spectrum, based on each galaxy's composition, which changes by a known amount if the galaxy is moving relative to us. Therefore, by analyzing the spectra of distant galaxies, Hubble was able to determine their velocities. He had expected to find as many galaxies moving away from us as moving toward us. Instead, he found that nearly all galaxies were moving away from us, and the farther away they were, the faster they were moving. Hubble concluded that the universe is expanding, but others, trying to hold on to the earlier model, attempted to explain his observations within the context of the static universe. For example, Caltech physicist Fritz Zwicky suggested that for some yet unknown reason, light might slowly lose energy as it travels great distances. This decrease in energy would correspond to a change in the light's spectrum, which Zwicky suggested could mimic Hubble's observations. For decades after Hubble, many scientists continued to hold on to the steady-state theory. But the most natural model was Hubble's, that of an expanding universe, and it has come to be the accepted one. In our quest to find the laws that govern the universe, we have formulated a number of theories or models, such as the four-element theory, the Ptolemaic model, the phlogiston theory, the Big Bang theory, and so on. With each theory or model, our concepts of reality and of the fundamental constituents of the universe have changed. For example, consider the theory of light. Newton thought that light was made up of little particles or corpuscles. This would explain why light travels in straight lines, and Newton also used it to explain why light is bent or refracted when it passes from one medium to another, such as from air to glass or air to water. The corpuscle theory could not, however, be used to explain a phenomenon that Newton himself observed, which is known as Newton's rings. Place a lens on a flat reflecting plate and illuminate it with light of a single color, such as a sodium light. Looking down from above, one will see a series of light and dark rings centered on where the lens touches the surface. This would be difficult to explain with the particle theory of light, but it can be accounted for in the wave theory. According to the wave theory of light, the light and dark rings are caused by a phenomenon called interference. A wave, such as a water wave, consists of a series of crests and troughs. When waves collide, if those crests and troughs happen to correspond, they reinforce each other, yielding a larger wave. That is called constructive interference. In that case, the waves are said to be in phase. At the other extreme, when the waves meet, the crests of one wave might coincide with the troughs of the other. In that case, the waves cancel each other and are said to be out of phase. That situation is called destructive interference. In Newton's rings, the bright rings are located at distances from the center, where the separation between the lens and the reflecting surface beneath it is an integral, 1, 2, 3, and so on, number of wavelengths. A wavelength is the distance between one crest or trough of a wave and the next. This means that the wave reflected from the lens will coincide with the wave reflected from the plate, creating constructive interference. The dark rings, on the other hand, are located at distances from the center where the separation between the two reflected waves is a half integral, 1/2, 1 1/2, 2 1/2, and so on, number of wavelengths, causing destructive interference. The wave reflected from the lens cancels the wave reflected from the plate. In the 19th century, this was taken as confirming the wave theory of light and showing that the particle theory was wrong. However, early in the 20th century, Einstein showed that the photoelectric effect, now used in television and digital cameras, could be explained by a particle or quantum of light striking an atom and knocking out an electron. Thus, light behaves as both particle and wave. The concept of waves probably entered human thought because people watched the ocean, or a puddle after a pebble fell into it. In fact, if you've ever dropped two pebbles into a puddle, you have probably seen interference at work. Other liquids were observed to behave in a similar fashion, except perhaps wine if you've had too much. The idea of particles was familiar from rocks, pebbles, and sand. But this wave-particle duality, the idea that an object could be described as either a particle or a wave, is as foreign to everyday experience as is the idea that you can drink a chunk of sandstone. Dualities like this, situations in which two very different theories accurately describe the same phenomenon, are consistent with model-dependent realism. Each theory can describe and explain certain properties, and neither theory can be said to be better or more real than the other. Regarding the laws that govern the universe, what we can say is this. There seems to be no single mathematical model or theory that can describe every aspect of the universe. Instead, as mentioned in the opening chapter, there seems to be the network of theories called M-theory. Each theory in the M-theory network is good at describing phenomena within a certain range. Wherever their ranges overlap, the various theories in the network agree, so they can all be said to be parts of the same theory. But no single theory within the network can describe every aspect of the universe, all the forces of nature, the particles that feel those forces, and the framework of space and time in which it all plays out. Though this situation does not fulfill the traditional physicist's dream of a single unified theory, it is acceptable within the framework of model-dependent realism. We will discuss duality and M-theory further in Chapter 5, but before that we turn to a fundamental principle upon which our modern view of nature is based, quantum theory, and in particular the approach to quantum theory called alternative histories. In that view, the universe does not have just a single existence or history, but rather every possible version of the universe exists simultaneously in what is called a quantum superposition. That may sound as outrageous as the theory in which the table disappears whenever we leave the room, but in this case, the theory has passed every experimental test to which it has ever been subjected. Chapter 4: Alternative Histories. In 1999, a team of physicists in Austria fired a series of soccer ball-shaped molecules toward a barrier. Those molecules, each made of 60 carbon atoms, are sometimes called buckyballs because the architect, Buckminster Fuller, built buildings of that shape. Fuller's geodesic domes were probably the largest soccer ball-shaped objects in existence. The buckyballs were the smallest. The barrier toward which the scientists took their aim had, in effect, two slits through which the buckyballs could pass. Beyond the wall, the physicists situated the equivalent of a screen to detect and count the emergent molecules. If we were to set up an analogous experiment with real soccer balls, we would need a player with somewhat shaky aim, but with the ability to launch the balls consistently at a speed of our choosing. We would position this player before a wall in which there are two gaps. On the far side of the wall and parallel to it, we would place a very long net. Most of the player's shots would hit the wall and bounce back, but some would go through one gap or the other and into the net. If the gaps were only slightly larger than the balls, two highly collimated streams would emerge on the other side. If the gaps were a bit wider than that, each stream would fan out a little. If we close off one of the gaps, the corresponding stream of balls would no longer get through, but this would have no effect on the other stream. If we reopened the second gap, that would only increase the number of balls that land at any given point on the other side, for we would then get all the balls that passed through the gap that had remained open, plus other balls coming from the newly opened gap. What we observe with both gaps open, in other words, is the sum of what we observe with each gap in the wall separately opened. That is the reality we are accustomed to in everyday life. But that's not what the Austrian researchers found when they fired their molecules. In the Austrian experiment, opening the second gap did indeed increase the number of molecules arriving at some points on the screen, but it decreased the number at others. In fact, there were spots where no buckyballs landed when both slits were open, but where balls did land when only one or the other gap was open. That seems very odd. How can opening a second gap cause fewer molecules to arrive at certain points? We can get a clue to the answer by examining the details. In the experiment, many of the molecular soccer balls landed at a spot centered halfway between where you would expect them to land if the balls went through either one gap or the other. A little farther out from that central position, very few molecules arrived, but a bit farther away from the center than that, molecules were again observed to arrive. This pattern is not the sum of the patterns formed when each gap is opened separately, but you may recognize it from Chapter 3 as the pattern characteristic of interfering waves. The areas where no molecules arrive correspond to regions in which waves emitted from the two gaps arrive out of phase and create destructive interference. The areas where many molecules arrive correspond to regions where the waves arrive in phase and create constructive interference. In the first 2,000 or so years of scientific thought, ordinary experience and intuition were the basis for theoretical explanation. As we improved our technology and expanded the range of phenomena that we could observe, we began to find nature behaving in ways that were less and less in line with our everyday experience, and hence with our intuition, as evidenced by the experiment with buckyballs. That experiment is typical of the type of phenomena that cannot be encompassed by classical science, but are described by what is called quantum physics. In fact, Richard Feynman wrote that the double slit experiment, like the one we described above, contains all the mystery of quantum mechanics. The principles of quantum physics were developed in the first few decades of the 20th century, after Newtonian theory was found to be inadequate for the description of nature on the atomic or subatomic level. The fundamental theories of physics describe the forces of nature and how objects react to them. Classical theories such as Newton's are built upon a framework reflecting everyday experience in which material objects have an individual existence, can be located at definite locations, follow definite paths, and so on. Quantum physics provides a framework for understanding how nature operates on atomic and subatomic scales. But as we'll see in more detail later, it dictates a completely different conceptual schema, one in which an object's position, path, and even its past and future are not precisely determined. Quantum theories of forces such as gravity or the electromagnetic force are built within that framework. Can theories built upon a framework so foreign to everyday experience also explain the events of ordinary experience that were modeled so accurately by classical physics? They can, for we and our surroundings are composite structures made of an unimaginably large number of atoms, more atoms than there are stars in the observable universe. And though the component atoms obey the principles of quantum physics, one can show that the large assemblages that form soccer balls, turnips, and jumbo jets, and us, will indeed manage to avoid diffracting through slits. So, though the components of everyday objects obey quantum physics, Newton's laws form an effective theory that describes very accurately how the composite structures that form our everyday world behave. That might sound strange, but there are many instances in science in which a large assemblage appears to behave in a manner that is different from the behavior of its individual components. The responses of a single neuron hardly portend those of the human brain, nor does knowing about a water molecule tell you much about the behavior of a lake. In the case of quantum physics, physicists are still working to figure out the details of how Newton's laws emerge from the quantum domain. What we do know is that the components of all objects obey the laws of quantum physics, and the Newtonian laws are a good approximation for describing the way macroscopic objects made of those quantum components behave. The predictions of Newtonian theory, therefore, match the view of reality we all develop as we experience the world around us. But individual atoms and molecules operate in a manner profoundly different from that of our everyday experience. Quantum physics is a new model of reality that gives us a picture of the universe. It is a picture in which many concepts fundamental to our intuitive understanding of reality no longer have meaning. The double slit experiment was first carried out in 1927 by Clinton Davison and Lester Germer, experimental physicists at Bell Labs, who were studying how a beam of electrons, objects much simpler than buckyballs, interacts with a crystal made of nickel. The fact that matter particles such as electrons behave like water waves was the type of startling experiment that inspired quantum physics. Since this behavior is not observed on a macroscopic scale, scientists have long wondered just how large and complex something could be and still exhibit such wave-like properties. It would cause quite a stir if the effect could be demonstrated using people or a hippopotamus, but as we've said, in general, the larger the object, the less apparent and robust are the quantum effects. So it is unlikely that any zoo animals will be passing wave-like through the bars of their cages. Still, experimental physicists have observed the wave phenomenon with particles of ever-increasing size. Scientists hope to replicate the buckyball experiment someday using a virus, which is not only far bigger, but also considered by some to be a living thing. There are only a few aspects of quantum physics needed to understand the arguments we will make in later chapters. One of the key features is wave-particle duality. That matter particles behave like a wave surprised everyone. That light behaves like a wave no longer surprises anyone. The wave-like behavior of light seems natural to us and has been considered an accepted fact for almost two centuries. If you shine a beam of light on the two slits in the above experiment, two waves will emerge and meet on the screen. At some points, their crests or troughs will coincide and form a bright spot. At others, the crests of one beam will meet the troughs of the other, cancelling them and leaving a dark area. The English physicist Thomas Young performed this experiment in the early 19th century, convincing people that light was a wave and not, as Newton had believed, composed of particles. Though one might conclude that Newton was wrong to say that light was not a wave, he was right when he said that light can act as if it is composed of particles. Today we call them photons. Just as we are composed of a large number of atoms, the light we see in everyday life is composite, in the sense that it is made of a great many photons. Even a 1-watt nightlight emits a billion billion each second. Single photons are not usually evident, but in the laboratory we can produce a beam of light so faint that it consists of a stream of single photons, which we can detect as individuals, just as we can detect individual electrons or buckyballs. And we can repeat Young's experiment employing a beam sufficiently sparse that the photons reach the barrier one at a time, with a few seconds between each arrival. If we do that, and then add up all the individual impacts recorded by the screen on the far side of the barrier, we find that together they build up the same interference pattern that would be built up if we performed the Davison-Germer experiment, but fired the electrons, or buckyballs, at the screen one at a time. To physicists, that was a startling revelation. If individual particles interfere with themselves, then the wave nature of light is the property not just of a beam or of a large collection of photons, but of the individual particles. Another of the main tenets of quantum physics is the uncertainty principle, formulated by Werner Heisenberg in 1926. The uncertainty principle tells us that there are limits to our ability to simultaneously measure certain data, such as the position and velocity of a particle. According to the uncertainty principle, for example, if you multiply the uncertainty in the position of a particle by the uncertainty in its momentum, its mass times its velocity, the result can never be smaller than a certain fixed quantity called Planck's constant. That's a tongue twister, but its gist can be stated simply. The more precisely you measure speed, the less precisely you can measure position, and vice versa. For instance, if you halve the uncertainty in position, you have to double the uncertainty in velocity. It is also important to note that, compared with everyday units of measurement such as meters, kilograms, and seconds, Planck's constant is very small. In fact, if reported in those units, it has the value of about 6 over 10, followed by 33 zeros. As a result, if you pinpoint a macroscopic object, such as a soccer ball, with a mass of 1/3 of a kilogram to within 1 millimeter in any direction, we can still measure its velocity with a precision far greater than even a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a kilometer per hour. That's because, measured in these units, the soccer ball has a mass of 1/3, and the uncertainty in position is 1/1000th. Neither is enough to account for all those zeros in Planck's constant, and so that role falls to the uncertainty in velocity. But in the same units, an electron has a mass of 10 to the minus 30th power, or a 1 preceded by a decimal, and 29 zeros. So for electrons, the situation is quite different. If we measure the position of an electron to a precision corresponding to roughly the size of an atom, the uncertainty principle dictates that we cannot know the electron speed more precisely than about plus or minus 1,000 kilometers per second, which is not very precise at all. According to quantum physics, no matter how much information we obtain or how powerful our computing abilities, the outcomes of physical processes cannot be predicted with certainty because they are not determined with certainty. Instead, given the initial state of a system, nature determines its future state through a process that is fundamentally uncertain. In other words, nature does not dictate the outcome of any process or experiment, even in the simplest of situations. Rather, it allows a number of different eventualities, each with a certain likelihood of being realized. It is, to paraphrase Einstein, as if God throws the dice before deciding the result of every physical process. That idea bothered Einstein, and so even though he was one of the fathers of quantum physics, he later became critical of it. Quantum physics might seem to undermine the idea that nature is governed by laws, but that is not the case. Instead, it leads us to accept a new form of determinism. Given the state of a system at some time, the laws of nature determine the probabilities of various futures and pasts, rather than determining the future and past with certainty. Though it is distasteful to some, scientists must accept theories that agree with experiment, not their own preconceived notions. What science does demand of a theory is that it be testable. If the probabilistic nature of the predictions of quantum physics meant it was impossible to confirm those predictions, then quantum theories would not qualify as valid theories. But despite the probabilistic nature of their predictions, we can still test quantum theories. For instance, we can repeat an experiment many times and confirm that the frequency of various outcomes conforms to the probabilities predicted. Consider the buckyball experiment. Quantum physics tells us that nothing is ever located at a definite point, because if it were, the uncertainty in momentum would have to be infinite. In fact, according to quantum physics, each particle has some probability of being found anywhere in the universe. So even if the chances of finding a given electron within the double-slit apparatus are very high, there will always be some chance that it could be found instead on the far side of the star Alpha Centauri or in the shepherd's pie at your office cafeteria. As a result, if you kick a quantum buckyball and let it fly, no amount of skill or knowledge will allow you to say in advance exactly where it will land. But if you repeat that experiment many times, the data you obtain will reflect the probability of finding the ball at various locations, and experimenters have confirmed that the results of such experiments agree with the theory's predictions. It is important to realize that probabilities in quantum physics are not like probabilities in Newtonian physics or in everyday life. We can understand this by comparing the patterns built up by the steady stream of buckyballs fired at a screen to the pattern of holes built up by players aiming for the bullseye on a dartboard. Unless the players have consumed too much beer, the chances of a dart landing near the center are greatest and diminish as you go farther out. As with the buckyballs, any given dart can land anywhere, and over time a pattern of holes that reflects the underlying probabilities will emerge. In everyday life, we might reflect that situation by saying that a dart has a certain probability of landing in various spots, but if we say that, unlike the case of the buckyballs, it is only because our knowledge of the conditions of its launch is incomplete. We could improve our description if we knew exactly the manner in which the player released the dart, its angle, spin, velocity, and so forth. In principle, then, we could predict where the dart will land with a precision as great as we desire. Our use of probabilistic terms to describe the outcome of events in everyday life is therefore a reflection not of the intrinsic nature of the process, but only of our ignorance of certain aspects of it. Probabilities in quantum theories are different. They reflect a fundamental randomness in nature. The quantum model of nature encompasses principles that contradict not only our everyday experience, but our intuitive concept of reality. Those who find those principles weird or difficult to believe are in good company, the company of great physicists such as Einstein and even Feynman, whose description of quantum theory we will soon present. In fact, Feynman once wrote, "I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." But quantum physics agrees with observation. It has never failed a test, and it has been tested more than any other theory in science. In the 1940s, Richard Feynman had a startling insight regarding the difference between the quantum and Newtonian worlds. Feynman was intrigued by the question of how the interference pattern in the double slit experiment arises. Recall that the pattern we find when we fire molecules with both slits open is not the sum of the patterns we find when we run the experiment twice, once with just one slit open, and once with only the other open. Instead, when both slits are open, we find a series of light and dark bands, the latter being regions in which no particles land. That means that particles that would have landed in the area of the dark band if, say, only slit 1 was open, do not land there when slit 2 is also open. It seems as if, somewhere on their journey from source to screen, the particles acquire information about both slits. That kind of behavior is drastically different from the way things seem to behave in everyday life, in which a ball would follow a path through one of the slits and be unaffected by the situation at the other. According to Newtonian physics, and to the way the experiment would work if we did it with soccer balls instead of molecules, each particle follows a single, well-defined route from its source to the screen. There is no room in this picture for a detour in which the particle visits the neighborhood of each slit along the way. According to the quantum model, however, the particle is said to have no definite position during the time it is between the starting point and the end point. Feynman realized one does not have to interpret that to mean that particles take no path as they travel between source and screen. It could mean instead that particles take every possible path connecting those points. This, Feynman asserted, is what makes quantum physics different from Newtonian physics. The situation at both slits matters because, rather than following a single definite path, particles take every path, and they take them all simultaneously. That sounds like science fiction, but it isn't. Feynman formulated a mathematical expression, the Feynman sum over histories, that reflects this idea and reproduces all the laws of quantum physics. In Feynman's theory, the mathematics and physical picture are different from that of the original formulation of quantum physics, but the predictions are the same. In the double-slit experiment, Feynman's ideas mean the particles take paths that go through only one slit or only the other. Paths that thread through the first slit, back out through the second slit, and then through the first again. Paths that visit the restaurant that serves that great curried shrimp and then circle Jupiter a few times before heading home, even paths that go across the universe and back. This, in Feynman's view, explains how the particle acquires the information about which slits are open. If a slit is open, the particle takes paths through it. When both slits are open, the paths in which the particle travels through one slit can interfere with the paths in which it travels through the other, causing the interference. It might sound nutty, but for the purposes of most fundamental physics done today, and for the purposes of this book, Feynman's formulation has proved more useful than the original one. Feynman's view of quantum reality is crucial in understanding the theories we will soon present, so it is worth taking some time to get a feeling for how it works. Imagine a simple process in which a particle begins at some location A and moves freely. In the Newtonian model, that particle will follow a straight line. After a certain precise time passes, we will find the particle at some precise location B along that line. In Feynman's model, a quantum particle samples every path connecting A and B, collecting a number called a phase for each path. That phase represents the position in the cycle of a wave, that is, whether the wave is at a crest or trough, or some precise position in between. Feynman's mathematical prescription for calculating that phase showed that when you add together the waves from all the paths, you get the probability amplitude that the particle, starting at A, will reach B. The square of that probability amplitude then gives the correct probability that the particle will reach B. The phase that each individual path contributes to the Feynman sum, and hence to the probability of going from A to B, can be visualized as an arrow that is of fixed length but can point in any direction. To add two phases, you place the arrow representing one phase at the end of the arrow representing the other to get a new arrow representing the sum. To add more phases, you simply continue the process. Note that when the phases line up, the arrow representing the total can be quite long, but if they point in different directions, they tend to cancel when you add them, leaving you with not much of an arrow at all. To carry out Feynman's prescription for calculating the probability amplitude that a particle beginning at a location A will end up at a location B, you add the phases, or arrows, associated with every path connecting A and B. There are an infinite number of paths, which makes the mathematics a bit complicated, but it works. Feynman's theory gives an especially clear picture of how a Newtonian world picture can arise from quantum physics, which seems very different. According to Feynman's theory, the phases associated with each path depend on Planck's constant. The theory dictates that because Planck's constant is so small, when you add the contribution from paths that are close to each other, the phases normally vary widely, and they tend to add to zero. But the theory also shows that there are certain paths for which the phases have a tendency to line up, and so those paths are favored, that is, they make a larger contribution to the observed behavior of the particle. It turns out that for large objects, paths very similar to the path predicted by Newton's will have similar phases and add up to give by far the largest contribution to the sum, and so the only destination that has a probability effectively greater than zero is the destination predicted by Newtonian theory, and that destination has a probability that is very nearly one. Hence, large objects move just as Newton's theory predicts they will. So far, we have discussed Feynman's ideas in the context of the double-slit experiment. In that experiment, particles are fired toward a wall with slits, and we measure the location on a screen placed beyond the wall at which the particles end up. More generally, instead of just a single particle, Feynman's theory allows us to predict the probable outcomes of a system, which could be a particle, a set of particles, or even the entire universe. Between the initial state of the system and our later measurement of its properties, those properties evolve in some way, which physicists call the system's history. In the double-slit experiment, for example, the history of the particle is simply its path. Just as for the double-slit experiment, the chance of observing the particle to land at any given point depends upon all the paths that could have gotten it there. Feynman showed that for a general system, the probability of any observation is constructed from all the possible histories that could have led to that observation. Because of that, his method is called the sum over histories, or alternative histories formulation of quantum physics. Now that we have a feeling for Feynman's approach to quantum physics, it is time to examine another key quantum principle that we will use later, the principle that observing a system must alter its course. Can't we, as we do when our supervisor has a spot of mustard on her chin, discreetly watch but not interfere? No. According to quantum physics, you cannot just observe something. That is, quantum physics recognizes that to make an observation, you must interact with the object you are observing. For instance, to see an object in the traditional sense, we shine a light on it. Shining a light on a pumpkin will, of course, have little effect on it. But shining even a dim light on a tiny quantum particle, that is, shooting photons at it, does have an appreciable effect. And experiments show that it changes the results of an experiment in just the way that quantum physics describes. Suppose that, as before, we send a stream of particles toward the barrier in the double slit experiment and collect data on the first million particles to get through. When we plot the number of particles landing at various detection points, the data will form an interference pattern. And when we add the phases associated with all the possible paths from a particle's starting point A to its detection point B, we will find that the probability we calculate of landing at various points agrees with that data. Now suppose we repeat the experiment, this time shining lights on the slits so that we know an intermediate point, C, through which the particle passed. C is the position of either one of the slits or the other. That is called which path information, because it tells us whether each particle went from A to slit 1 to B, or from A to slit 2 to B. Since we now know through which slit each particle passed, the paths in our sum for that particle will now include only paths that travel through slit 1, or only paths that travel through slit 2. It will never include both the paths that go through slit 1 and the paths that pass through slit 2. Because Feynman explained the interference pattern by saying that paths that go through one slit interfere with paths that go through the other, if you turn on a light to determine which slit the particles pass through, thereby eliminating the other option, you will make the interference pattern disappear. And indeed, when the experiment is performed, turning on a light changes the results. Moreover, we can vary the experiment by employing very faint light so that not all of the particles interact with the light. In that case, we are able to obtain which path information for only some subset of the particles. If we then divide the data on particle arrivals according to whether or not we obtained which path information, we find that data pertaining to the subset for which we have no which path information will form an interference pattern, and the subset of data pertaining to the particles for which we do have which path information will not show interference. This idea has important implications for our concept of the past. In Newtonian theory, the past is assumed to exist as a definite series of events. If you see that vase you bought in Italy last year lying smashed on the floor and your toddler standing over it looking sheepish, you can trace backward the events that led to the mishap, the little fingers letting go, the vase falling and exploding into 1,000 pieces as it hits. In fact, given complete data about the present, Newton's laws allow one to calculate a complete picture of the past. This is consistent with our intuitive understanding that, whether painful or joyful, the world has a definite past. There may have been no one watching, but the past exists as surely as if you had taken a series of snapshots of it. But a quantum buckyball cannot be said to have taken a definite path from source to screen. We might pin down a buckyball's location by observing it, but in between our observations, it takes all paths. Quantum physics tells us that no matter how thorough our observation of the present, the unobserved past, like the future, is indefinite and exists only as a spectrum of possibilities. The universe, according to quantum physics, has no single past or history. The fact that the past takes no definite form means that observations you make on a system in the present affect its past. That is underlined rather dramatically by a type of experiment thought up by physicist John Wheeler called a delayed choice experiment. Schematically, a delayed choice experiment is like the double slit experiment we just described, in which you have the option of observing the path that the particle takes, except in the delayed choice experiment, you postpone your decision about whether or not to observe the path until just before the particle hits the detection screen. Delayed choice experiments result in data identical to those we get when we choose to observe, or not observe, the which path information by watching the slits themselves. But in this case, the path each particle takes, that is, its past, is determined long after it passed through the slits and presumably had to decide whether to travel through just one slit, which does not produce interference, or both slits, which does. Wheeler even considered a cosmic version of the experiment, in which the particles involved are photons emitted by powerful quasars billions of light years away. Such light could be split into two paths and refocused toward Earth by the gravitational lensing of an intervening galaxy. Though the experiment is beyond the reach of current technology, if we could collect enough photons from this light, they ought to form an interference pattern. Yet, if we place a device to measure which path information shortly before detection, that pattern should disappear. The choice whether to take one or both paths in this case would have been made billions of years ago, before the Earth or perhaps even our Sun was formed, and yet with our observation in the laboratory, we will be affecting that choice. In this chapter, we have illustrated quantum physics employing the double slit experiment. In what follows, we will apply Feynman's formulation of quantum mechanics to the universe as a whole. We will see that, like a particle, the universe doesn't have just a single history, but every possible history, each with its own probability, and our observations of its current state affect its past and determine the different histories of the universe, just as the observations of the particles in the double slit experiment affect the particles' past. That analysis will show how the laws of nature in our universe arose from the Big Bang. But before we examine how the laws arose, we'll talk a little bit about what those laws are and some of the mysteries that they provoke. Chapter 5: The Theory of Everything. The most incomprehensible thing about the universe is that it is comprehensible. Albert Einstein. The universe is comprehensible because it is governed by scientific laws, that is to say, its behavior can be modeled. But what are these laws or models? The first force to be described in mathematical language was gravity. Newton's law of gravity, published in 1687, said that every object in the universe attracts every other object with a force proportional to its mass. It made a great impression on the intellectual life of its era, because it showed for the first time that at least one aspect of the universe could be accurately modeled, and it established the mathematical machinery to do so. The idea that there are laws of nature brings up issues similar to that for which Galileo had been convicted of heresy about 50 years earlier. For instance, the Bible tells the story of Joshua praying for the sun and moon to stop in their trajectories so he would have extra daylight to finish fighting the Amorites in Canaan. According to the book of Joshua, the sun stood still for about a day. Today we know that that would have meant that the earth stopped rotating. If the earth stopped, according to Newton's laws, anything not tied down would have remained in motion at the earth's original speed, 1,100 miles per hour at the equator, a high price to pay for a delayed sunset. None of this bothered Newton himself, for, as we've said, Newton believed that God could and did intervene in the workings of the universe. The next aspects of the universe for which a law or model was discovered were the electric and magnetic forces. These behave like gravity, with the important difference that two electric charges or two magnets of the same kind repel each other, while unlike charges or unlike magnets attract. Electric and magnetic forces are far stronger than gravity, but we don't usually notice them in everyday life, because a macroscopic body contains almost equal numbers of positive and negative electrical charges. This means that the electric and magnetic forces between two macroscopic bodies nearly cancel each other out, unlike the gravitational forces, which all add up. Our current ideas about electricity and magnetism were developed over a period of about 100 years, from the mid-18th to the mid-19th century, when physicists in several countries made detailed experimental studies of electric and magnetic forces. One of the most important discoveries was that electrical and magnetic forces are related. A moving electrical charge causes a force on magnets, and a moving magnet causes a force on electrical charges. The first to realize there was some connection was Danish physicist Hans Christian Oersted. While setting up for a lecture he was to give at the university in 1820, Oersted noticed that the electric current from the battery he was using deflected a nearby compass needle. He soon realized that moving electricity created a magnetic force and coined the term electromagnetism. A few years later, British scientist Michael Faraday reasoned that, expressed in modern terms, if an electric current could cause a magnetic field should be able to produce an electric current. He demonstrated that effect in 1831. 14 years later, Faraday also discovered a connection between electromagnetism and light, when he showed that intense magnetism can affect the nature of polarized light. Faraday had little formal education. He had been born into a poor blacksmith's family near London and left school at age 13 to work as an errand boy and bookbinder in a bookshop. There, over the years, he learned science by reading the books he was supposed to care for and by performing simple and cheap experiments in his spare time. Eventually, he obtained work as an assistant in the laboratory of the great chemist Sir Humphrey Davy. Faraday would stay on for the remaining 45 years of his life and, after Davy's death, succeed him. Faraday had trouble with mathematics and never learned much of it, so it was a struggle for him to conceive a theoretical picture of the odd electromagnetic phenomena he observed in his laboratory. Nevertheless, he did. One of Faraday's greatest intellectual innovations was the idea of force fields. These days, thanks to books and movies about bug-eyed aliens and their starships, most people are familiar with the term, so maybe he should get a royalty. But in the centuries between Newton and Faraday, one of the great mysteries of physics was that its laws seemed to indicate that forces act across the empty space that separates interacting objects. Faraday didn't like that. He believed that to move an object, something has to come into contact with it. And so he imagined the space between electric charges and magnets as being filled with invisible tubes that physically do the pushing and pulling. Faraday called those tubes a force field. A good way to visualize a force field is to perform the schoolroom demonstration in which a glass plate is placed over a bar magnet and iron filings spread on the glass. With a few taps to overcome friction, the filings move as if nudged by an unseen power and arrange themselves in a pattern of arcs stretching from one pole of the magnet to the other. That pattern is a map of the unseen magnetic force that permeates space. Today, we believe that all forces are transmitted by fields, so it is an important concept in modern physics as well as science fiction. For several decades, our understanding of electromagnetism remained stalled, amounting to no more than the knowledge of a few empirical laws, the hint that electricity and magnetism were closely, if mysteriously, related, the notion that they had some sort of connection to light, and the embryonic concept of fields. At least 11 theories of electromagnetism existed, every one of them flawed. Then, over a period of years in the 1860s, Scottish physicist James Clerk Maxwell developed Faraday's thinking into a mathematical framework that explained the intimate and mysterious relation among electricity, magnetism, and light. The result was a set of equations describing both electric and magnetic forces as manifestations of the same physical entity, the electromagnetic field. Maxwell had unified electricity and magnetism into one force. Moreover, he showed that electromagnetic fields could propagate through space as a wave. The speed of that wave is governed by a number that appeared in his equations, which he calculated from experimental data that had been measured a few years earlier. To his astonishment, the speed he calculated equaled the speed of light, which was then known experimentally to an accuracy of 1%. He had discovered that light itself is an electromagnetic wave. Today, the equations that describe electric and magnetic fields are called Maxwell's equations. Few people have heard of them, but they are probably the most commercially important equations we know. Not only do they govern the working of everything from household appliances to computers, but they also describe waves other than light, such as microwaves, radio waves, infrared light, and X-rays. All of these differ from visible light in only one respect, their wavelength. Radio waves have wavelengths of a meter or more, while visible light has a wavelength of a few 10 millionths of a meter, and X-rays a wavelength shorter than 100 millionth of a meter. Our sun radiates at all wavelengths, but its radiation is most intense in the wavelengths that are visible to us. It's probably no accident that the wavelengths we are able to see with the naked eye are those in which the sun radiates most strongly. It's likely that our eyes evolved with the ability to detect electromagnetic radiation in that range, precisely because that is the range of radiation most available to them. If we ever run into beings from other planets, they will probably have the ability to see radiation at whatever wavelengths their own sun emits most strongly, modulated by factors such as the light-blocking characteristics of the dust and gases in their planet's atmosphere. So aliens who evolved in the presence of X-rays might have a nice career in airport security. Maxwell's equations dictate that electromagnetic waves travel at a speed of about 300,000 kilometers a second, or about 670 million miles per hour. But to quote a speed means nothing unless you specify a frame of reference relative to which the speed is measured. That's not something you usually need to think about in everyday life. When a speed limit sign reads 60 miles per hour, it is understood that your speed is measured relative to the road and not the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. But even in everyday life, there are occasions in which you have to take into account reference frames. For example, if you carry a cup of tea up the aisle of a jet plane in flight, you might say your speed is 2 miles per hour. Someone on the ground, however, might say you are moving at 572 miles per hour. Lest you think that one or the other of those observers has a better claim to the truth, keep in mind that because the Earth orbits the Sun, someone watching you from the surface of that heavenly body would disagree with both and say you are moving at about 18 miles per second, not to mention envying your air conditioning. In light of such disagreements, when Maxwell claimed to have discovered the speed of light popping out of his equations, the natural question was, what is the speed of light in Maxwell's equations measured relative to? There is no reason to believe that the speed parameter in Maxwell's equations is a speed measured relative to the Earth. His equations, after all, apply to the entire universe. An alternative answer that was considered for a while is that his equations specify the speed of light relative to a previously undetected medium permeating all space, called the luminiferous ether, or for short, simply the ether, which was Aristotle's term for the substance he believed filled all of the universe outside the terrestrial sphere. This hypothetical ether would be the medium through which electromagnetic waves propagate, just as sound propagates through air. If the ether existed, there would be an absolute standard of rest, that is, rest with respect to the ether, and hence an absolute way of defining motion as well. The ether would provide a preferred frame of reference throughout the entire universe, against which any object speed could be measured. So the ether was postulated to exist on theoretical grounds, setting some scientists off on a search for a way to study it, or at least to confirm its existence. One of those scientists was Maxwell himself. If you race through the air toward a sound wave, the wave approaches you faster, and if you race away, it approaches you more slowly. Similarly, if there were an ether, the speed of light would vary depending on your motion relative to the ether. In fact, if light worked the way sound does, just as people on a supersonic jet will never hear any sound that emanates from behind the plane, so too would travelers racing quickly enough through the ether be able to outrun a light wave. Working from such considerations, Maxwell suggested an experiment. If there is an ether, the Earth must be moving through it as it orbits the Sun. And since the Earth is traveling in a different direction in January than, say, in April or July, one ought to be able to observe a tiny difference in the speed of light at different times of the year. Maxwell was talked out of publishing his idea in Proceedings of the Royal Society by its editor, who didn't think the experiment would work. But in 1879, shortly before he died at age 48 of painful stomach cancer, Maxwell sent a letter on the subject to a friend. The letter was published posthumously in the journal Nature, where it was read by, among others, an American physicist named Albert Michelson. Inspired by Maxwell's speculation, in 1887, Michelson and Edward Morley carried out a very sensitive experiment designed to measure the speed at which the Earth travels through the ether. Their idea was to compare the speed of light in two different directions, at right angles. If the speed of light were a fixed number relative to the ether, the measurements should have revealed light speeds that differed depending on the direction of the beam. But Michelson and Morley observed no such difference. The outcome of the Michelson and Morley experiment is clearly in conflict with the model of electromagnetic waves traveling through an ether and should have caused the ether model to be abandoned. But Michelson's purpose had been to measure the speed of the Earth relative to the ether, not to prove or disprove the ether hypothesis, and what he found did not lead him to conclude that the ether didn't exist. No one else drew that conclusion either. In fact, the famous physicist Sir William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, said in 1884 that the ether was the only substance we are confident of in dynamics, one thing we are sure of, and that is the reality and substantiality of the luminiferous ether. How can you believe in the ether despite the results of the Michelson-Morley experiment? As we've said, often happens, people tried to save the model by contrived and ad hoc additions. Some postulated that the Earth dragged the ether along with it, so we weren't actually moving with respect to it. Dutch physicist Hendrik Anton Lorentz and Irish physicist George Francis Fitzgerald suggested that in a frame that was moving with respect to the ether, probably due to some yet unknown mechanical effect, clocks would slow down and distances would shrink, so one would still measure light to have the same speed. Such efforts to save the ether concept continued for nearly 20 years, until a remarkable paper by a young and unknown clerk in the patent office in Bern, Albert Einstein. Einstein was 26 in 1905 when he published his paper Zur Elektrodynamik bewegter Körper, on the electrodynamics of moving bodies. In it, he made the simple assumption that the laws of physics, and in particular the speed of light, should appear to be the same to all uniformly moving observers. This idea, it turns out, demands a revolution in our concept of space and time. To see why, imagine two events that take place at the same spot but at different times in a jet aircraft. To an observer on the jet, there will be zero distance between those two events. But to a second observer on the ground, the events will be separated by the distance the jet has traveled in the time between the events. This shows that two observers who are moving relative to each other will not agree on the distance between two events. Now suppose the two observers observe a pulse of light traveling from the tail of the aircraft to its nose. Just as in the above example, They will not agree on the distance the light has traveled from its emission at the plane's tail to its reception at the nose. Since speed is distance traveled divided by the time taken, this means that if they agree on the speed at which the pulse travels, the speed of light, they will not agree on the time interval between the emission and the reception. What makes this strange is that, though the two observers measure different times, they are watching the same physical process. Einstein didn't attempt to construct an artificial explanation for this. He drew the logical, if startling, conclusion that the measurement of the time taken, like the measurement of the distance covered, depends on the observer doing the measuring. That effect is one of the keys to the theory in Einstein's 1905 paper, which has come to be called special relativity. We can see how this analysis could apply to timekeeping devices if we consider two observers looking at a clock. Special relativity holds that the clock runs faster according to an observer who is at rest with respect to the clock. To observers who are not at rest with respect to the clock runs slower. If we liken a light pulse traveling from the tail to the nose of the plane to the tick of a clock, we see that to an observer on the ground, the clock runs slower because the light beam has to travel a greater distance in that frame of reference. But the effect does not depend on the mechanism of the clock. It holds for all clocks, even our own biological ones. Einstein's work showed that, like the concept of rest, time cannot be absolute, as Newton thought. In other words, it is not possible to assign to every event a time with which every observer will agree. Instead, all observers have their own measures of time, and the times measured by two observers who are moving relative to each other will not agree. Einstein's ideas go counter to our intuition, because their implications aren't noticeable at the speeds we normally encounter in everyday life, but they have been repeatedly confirmed by experiment. For example, imagine a reference clock at rest at the center of the Earth, another clock on the Earth's surface, and a third clock aboard a plane, flying either with or against the direction of the Earth's rotation. With reference to the clock at the Earth's center, the clock aboard the plane moving eastward in the direction of the Earth's rotation is moving faster than the clock on the Earth's surface, and so it should run slower. Similarly, with reference to the clock at the Earth's center, the clock aboard the plane flying westward against the Earth's rotation is moving slower than the surface clock, which means that clock should run faster than the clock on the surface. And that is exactly what was observed when, in an experiment performed in October 1971, a very accurate atomic clock was flown around the world. So you could extend your life by constantly flying eastward around the world, though you might get tired of watching all those airline movies. However, the effect is very small, about 180 billionths of a second per circuit, and it is also somewhat lessened by the effects of the difference in gravity, but we need not get into that here. Due to the work of Einstein, physicists realized that by demanding that the speed of light be the same in all frames of reference, Maxwell's theory of electricity and magnetism dictates that time cannot be treated as separate from the three dimensions of space. Instead, time and space are intertwined. It is something like adding a fourth direction of future-past to the usual left-right, forward-backward, and up-down. Physicists call this marriage of space and time space-time, and because space-time includes a fourth direction, they call it the fourth dimension. In space-time, time is no longer separate from the three dimensions of space. And, loosely speaking, just as the definition of left-right, forward-backward, or up-down depends on the orientation of the observer, so too does the direction of time vary depending on the speed of the observer. Observers moving at different speeds would choose different directions for time in space-time. Einstein's theory of special relativity was therefore a new model, which got rid of the concepts of absolute time and absolute rest, i.e. rest with respect to the fixed ether. Einstein soon realized that to make gravity compatible with relativity, another change was necessary. According to Newton's theory of gravity, at any given time, objects are attracted to each other by a force that depends on the distance between them at that time. But the theory of relativity had abolished the concept of absolute time, so there was no way to define when the distance between the masses should be measured. Thus, Newton's theory of gravity was not consistent with special relativity and had to be modified. The conflict might sound like a mere technical difficulty, perhaps even a detail that could somehow be worked around without much change in the theory. As it turned out, nothing could have been further from the truth.